afternoon. People who might have been driving or walking down Manor Road. "Did you see a man walking down the road this afternoon, Dawn?" he asked. "Mr. Spencer across the road says he saw a man with long hair, in a dark coat. Someone he hadn't seen before. It might be nothing." She shook her head, tears already sliding down her face. "Was it him that took her?" she said. "Was it him who took my baby?"
Chapter 6. The Widow. Wednesday, June 9th, 2010. More feet on the gravel. This time Kate's phone rings twice and stops. Must be some sort of signal, because she immediately opens the front door and lets in a man with a big bag over his shoulder. "This is Mick," she says to me, "my photographer." Mick grins at me and sticks out his hand. "Hello, Mrs. Taylor," he says. He's come to pick us up and take us to a hotel. "Somewhere nice and quiet," he says, and I begin to protest. Everything's moving so fast. "Wait a minute," I say, but no one is listening. Kate and Mick are discussing getting past the reporters who've gathered at the gate. The man from the telly must have told people I had someone in the house, and they're taking turns knocking on the door and opening the letterbox to shout to me. It's awful. Like a nightmare. Like it was at the beginning. Then they were shouting at Glenn, accusing him of all sorts of things. "What have you done, Mr. Taylor?" one shouted. "Have you got blood on your hands, you pervert?" the man from the Sun had said, as Glenn took the bin out, right in front of people walking by. Glenn said one of them spat on the pavement. He was shaking when he came in. My poor Glenn. But he had me to help him then. I would stroke his hand and tell him to pay no attention. But there's just me now, and I don't know if I can cope on my own. A voice is yelling horrible things through the door. "I know you're there, Mrs. Taylor. Are you being paid to talk? What do you think people will say if you take this blood money?" I feel like I've been hit, and Kate turns and strokes my hand and tells me to ignore it. She can make it all go away. I want to trust her, but it's hard to think straight. What does making it all go away mean? Hiding has been the only way to deal with it, according to Glenn. "We have to wait it out," he would say. But Kate's way is to go at it head on. Stand up and say my piece to shut them up. I would like to shut them up, but it means being in the spotlight. The thought is so terrifying I can't move. "Come on, Jean," Kate says, finally noticing me, still sitting in the chair. "We can do this together, one step at a time. It'll all be over in 5 minutes, and then no one will be able to find you. Apart from her, of course." I know I can't face more of the abuse from those animals outside, so I obediently start to get my stuff together. I pick up my handbag and stuff some knickers into it from the tumble dryer in the kitchen. Upstairs to get my toothbrush. Where are my keys? "Just the essentials," Kate says. She will buy me anything I need when we get there. "Get where?" I want to ask. But Kate has turned away again. She's busy on her mobile, talking to the office. She has a different voice when she talks to the office. Tense. A bit breathless. Like she's just walked upstairs. "Okay, Terry," she says. "No, Jean is with us, so I'll give you a call later." She doesn't want to talk in front of me. Wonder what the office wants to know. How much money she's promised? What I will look like in the pictures? I bet she wanted to say, "She's a bit of a mess, but we can make her look presentable." I feel panicky and go to say I've changed my mind, but everything's moving too fast. She says she's going to distract them. She'll go out the front door and pretend to get her car ready for us while Mick and I slip down the garden and over the fence at the back. I can't really believe I'm doing this. I start to say, "Hang on," again, but Kate is pushing me toward the back door. We wait while she goes out. The noise is suddenly deafening. Like a flock of birds taking off by my front door. "Snappers," Mick says. I guess he means photographers. Then he throws his jacket over my head, grabs my hand, and pulls me along behind him out the back door, into the garden. I can't see much because of the jacket, and I've got stupid shoes on. My feet are sliding out of them, but I try to run. This is ridiculous. The jacket keeps slipping off. Oh, God, there's Lisa next door, looking out of her top window, mouth open. I wave my hand limply. God knows why. We haven't spoken for ages. At the back fence, Mick helps me over. It's not high, really. More for show than security. I've got trousers on, but it's still a bit of a struggle. He's parked his car around the corner, he says, and we creep slowly to the end of the alley, behind the houses, in case one of the reporters is there. I suddenly want to cry. I'm about to get into a car, with people I don't know, and head off to God knows where. It's probably the craziest thing I've ever done. Glenn would have had a fit. Even before all the police stuff, he liked to keep things private. We lived in this house for years, all our married life, but, as the neighbours were only too glad to tell the press, we kept ourselves to ourselves. It's what neighbours always say, isn't it, when dead bodies or mistreated children are found next door? But in our case, it was true. One of them, it could have been Mrs. Grange opposite, described Glenn to a reporter as having evil eyes. He had nice eyes, actually. Blue with longish lashes. Little boy eyes. His eyes could turn me over inside. Anyway, he used to say to me, "Nobody's business but ours, Jeannie." That was why it was so hard, when our business became everyone else's. Mick, the photographer's van, is filthy. You can't see the floor for burger boxes, crisp packets and old newspapers. There's an electric razor plugged into the lighter thing, and a big bottle of Coke rolling around in the footwell. "Sorry about the mess," he says. "I practically live in this van. Anyway, I'm not getting in the front." Mick takes me around the back and opens the doors. "In here," he says, grasping my arm and guiding me in. He puts his hand on my head and ducks me down so I don't bang my head. "Keep down when we drive off, and I'll give you the all clear." "But," I start to say, but he slammed the doors, and I'm sitting in semi-darkness, among camera gear and dustbin bags.
Chapter 7. The Detective. Thursday, October 5th, 2006. Bob Sparks yawned loudly, stretching his arms above his head and arching his aching back in his office chair. He tried not to look at the clock on the desk, but it winked at him until he focused. It was 2 a.m. Day 3 of the hunt for Bella over, and they were getting nowhere. Dozens of calls about long-haired, scruffy men and other leads were being checked in an ever-widening circle from the locus, but it was meticulous, slow work. He tried not to think about what was happening to Bella Elliott, or, if he was honest, what had already happened. He had to find her. "Where are you, Bella?" he asked the photo on his desk. The child's face was everywhere he looked. The incident room had a dozen photographs of her, smiling down at the desk-bound detectives like small religious icons giving a blessing to their work. The papers were full of pictures of baby Bella. Sparks ran his hand over his head, registering the growing bald patch. "Come on, think," he told himself, leaning in to the computer screen. He read once more through the statements and reports from the trawl of the local sex offenders, searching for the tiniest weaknesses in their individual stories, but he could see no real leads. He scanned through the profiles one last time. Pathetic creatures, most of them. Solitary blokes with body odour and bad teeth, living in a fantasy online universe and occasionally straying into the real world to try their luck. Then there were the persistent offenders. His officers had gone to Paul Silver's house. He'd abused his kids over the years and had done time for it. But his wife, his third, he wondered. Or is it still Diane? Confirmed wearily that her old man was inside, doing 5 years for burglary. Diversifying, apparently, Bob Sparks had told his sergeant. Naturally, there'd been sightings of Bella reported all over the country in the first 48 hours. Officers had rushed off to check, and some calls had got his heart racing. A woman from just outside Newark had rung to say a new neighbour had been playing in the garden with a child. "She's a little blonde girl. I'd never seen a child in the garden before. I thought she didn't have kids," she said. Sparks sent the local force around immediately and waited at his desk for the phone to ring. "It's the neighbour's niece, visiting from Scotland," the local DI had told him, as disappointed as him. "Sorry, maybe next time." Maybe. His problem was that most of the calls to the incident room were always going to be from chancers and attention seekers, desperate to be part of the drama. The bottom line was that the last sighting of Bella by anyone other than Dawn was at the newsagent's shop down the road. The owner, a mouthy grandmother, remembered mother and child coming into the shop around 11:30. They were regulars. Dawn went in most days to buy cigarettes, and this visit, Bella's last, was recorded in the grainy stop-start images of the shop's cheap security camera. Here, little Bella holding her mother's hand at the counter. Cut to Bella, face blurred and indistinct, as if she were already disappearing, with a paper bag in her hand. Cut to shop door, closing behind her. Dawn's mum had phoned the house after lunch, 2:17, according to her phone records, and told police she'd heard her granddaughter shouting along to Bob the Builder in the background and asked to speak to her. Dawn had called her, but Bella had apparently run off to fetch a toy. The timeline of the next 68 minutes was Dawn's. It was vague, punctuated by her household chores. The detectives had got her to reenact the cooking, washing up, and folding of Bella's clothes from the tumble dryer to try to get a sense of the minutes that passed after Dawn said she saw Bella wander into the garden to play just after 3 o'clock. Margaret Emerson, who lived next door, had gone to fetch something from her car at 3:25 p.m. and was sure the front garden was empty. "Bella always shouted, 'Peepo!' to me. It was a bit of a game for her, poor little thing. She loved attention. Her mum wasn't always interested in what she was doing," Mrs. Emerson said carefully. "Bella used to play on her own a lot, carting her dolly round and chasing Timmy the cat. You know what kids get up to." "Did Bella cry a lot?" Sparks had asked. It had given Mrs. Emerson pause for thought, but then she'd shaken her head and said briskly, "No, she was a happy little thing." The family doctor and health visitor agreed. "Lovely child. Little poppet," they chorused. "Mum struggled a bit on her own. It's hard bringing up a child alone, isn't it?" the doctor said, and Sparks nodded as if he understood. All of this was logged away in the now-bulging files of evidence and statements, proof of the effort his blokes were making. But he knew it was all surface chatter. They were making no progress. The long-haired man was the key, he concluded, switching off his computer and carefully stacking the files on his desk before heading for the door and 5 hours of sleep. "Maybe tomorrow we'll find her," he whispered to his sleeping wife when he got home. A week later, with no news, Kate Waters was on the phone. "Hi, Bob. The editor has decided to offer a reward for any information that leads to Bella being found. He's putting up 20 grand. Not too shabby." Sparks groaned inwardly. "Bloody rewards," he cursed to Matthews later. "The papers get all the publicity, and we'll get every nutter and con man in the country on the phone."
That's very generous, Kate," he said. "But do you think this is the right moment? We're working on a number..."
"It's going on the front page tomorrow, Bob," she interrupted. "Look, I know the police usually hate the idea of rewards, But people who see or hear things and are worried about ringing the police will see 20 grand and pick up the phone.
He sighed. I'll go and tell Dawn, he said. I need to prepare her.
Right, Kate said. Look, what are the chances of getting a sit-down chat with Dawn, Bob? Poor woman could barely speak at the press conference. This would be a proper chance for her to talk about Bella. I'll be very gentle with her. What do you think?
He thought he wished he hadn't answered her call. He liked Kate, and there weren't many reporters he could say that about. But he knew she was like a terrier with a bone when she was after something. He knew she wouldn't let up until she got what she wanted. But he wasn't sure he and Dawn were ready for this sort of grilling. Dawn was still a largely unknown quantity, an emotional mess, drugged against her terror and unable to focus on anything for more than 30 seconds. Bob Sparks had spent hours with the young mother, and he felt he'd only scratched the surface. Could he really let Kate Waters loose on her? It might help her to talk to someone who isn't a police officer, Bob. Might help her remember something.
I'll ask her, Kate, but I'm not sure she's up to it. She's on tranquilizers and sleeping pills and is finding it hard to concentrate on anything.
Brilliant. Thanks, Bob.
He could hear the smile in the reporter's voice.
Hold on. It's not a done deal yet. Let me talk to her this morning and I'll give you a ring back.
When he arrived, he found Dawn sitting in exactly the same spot, among Bella's toys, cards from well-wishers, and letters on lined notepaper from the mad and angry, crushed empty packs of cigarettes, and pages torn from newspapers on the sofa that had become the mother's ark.
"Have you been to bed, love?" he asked her.
Sue Blackman, a young woman in uniform acting as the family liaison officer, shook her head silently and raised her eyebrows.
"Can't sleep," Dawn said. "Need to be awake for when she comes home."
Sparks took PC Blackman into the hall.
"She needs some rest, or she's going to end up in the hospital," he hissed. "I know, sir. She's dozing on the sofa during the day, but she hates it when it gets dark. She says Bella is afraid of the dark."
Chapter 8. The Reporter. Wednesday, October 11th, 2006. Kate Waters arrived at the house at lunchtime with a photographer and a bunch of ostentatious supermarket lilies. She'd parked down the road, away from the pack, so she could get out of the car without attracting attention. She rang Bob Sparks to let him know she was there and swept past the journalist sitting outside the house in their cars, Big Macs in their fists. By the time they'd leapt from their vehicles, she was inside. She heard a couple of them swearing loudly, warning one another they were about to be shafted, and tried not to grin. As Bob Sparks led the way, Kate took it all in. The shambles and stasis created by grief. In the hall, Bella's blue anorak with a fur-lined hood and teddy bear backpack hanging on the banister. Her tiny, shiny red wellies by the door.
"Get a photo of those, Mick," she whispered to the photographer following her as they made their way into the front room. There were toys and baby photos everywhere, the scene taking Kate straight back to her own early days of motherhood, struggling against the tide of chaos. She had sat and cried the day she brought Jake home from the hospital, lost in the postpartum hormonal wash and sudden sense of responsibility. She remembered she'd asked the nurse if she could pick him up the morning after he was born, as if he belonged to the hospital. The mother looked up, her young face creased and made old by weeping, and Kate smiled and took her hand. She had planned to shake it, but simply squeezed it instead.
"Hello, Dawn," she said. "Thank you so much for agreeing to talk to me. I know how hard it must be for you,
but we hope it will help the police find Bella. Dawn nodded as if in slow motion. Bloody hell, Bob wasn't kidding, Kate thought. She picked up a red Teletubbies doll from the sofa. Is this Poe? My boys preferred Power Rangers, she said. Dawn looked at her interested. Bella loves Poe, she said. She likes blowing bubbles, chases after them, trying to catch them. Kate had noticed a photo of the toddler doing exactly that on a table and got up to bring it to Dawn. Here she is, she said, and Dawn took the frame in her hands. She's a beautiful little girl, Kate said. Full of mischief, I bet. Dawn smiled gratefully. The two women had found their common ground, motherhood, and Dawn started to talk about her baby. First time she's been able to talk about Bella as a child, not a crime victim, Bob Sparks thought. Kate's good. You have to give her that. She can get inside your head quicker than a lot of my coppers, he told his wife later. Eileen had shrugged and returned to the telegraph crossword. Police work took place on a different planet as far as she was concerned. Kate had fetched more photos and toys to keep the conversation flowing, letting Dawn tell her story about each item with barely a question needed. She used a discreet tape recorder, slipped quickly onto the cushion between them, to capture every word. Notebooks were a bad idea in a situation like this. It would be too much like a police interview. She just wanted Dawn to talk. She wanted to hear about the ordinary pleasures and everyday struggles of being a mum, of getting Bella ready for nursery school, bath time games, the child's delight at choosing her new wellies. She loves animals. We went to the zoo once, and she wanted to stay watching the monkeys. She laughed and laughed, Dawn told her, taking temporary shelter in memories of a previous life. The glimpses of Bella and Dawn would bring the reader straight into the nightmare the young mother was enduring, Kate knew, writing the intro in her head. A pair of tiny red Wellington boots stand in Dawn Elliott's hallway. Her daughter, Bella, chose them 2 weeks ago and has yet to wear them. This was what the public wanted to read, so they could shiver in their dressing gowns over tea and toast and say to their spouse, "This could have been us." And the editor would love it. "Perfect womb trembler," he'd say, and clear the front and a spread inside the paper for her story. After 20 minutes, Dawn began to tire. The drugs were beginning to wear off, and the terror crept back into the room. Kate glanced at Mick, and he stood up with his camera and said gently, "Let's take a photo of you, Dawn, with that lovely picture of Bella blowing bubbles." She complied, like a child herself. "I'll never forgive myself," she whispered as Mick's shutter clicked. "I shouldn't have let her go outside, but I was just trying to get her tea ready. She was out of sight for only a minute. I'd do anything to turn the clock back." And then she cried, dry sobs shaking her frame as Kate held her hand tightly and the rest of the world came back into focus around the sofa. Kate always marveled at the power of interview. When you're talking to real people, people without an ego or something to sell, it can be complete exposure of one person to another, an intense intimacy that excludes everyone and everything else, she told someone once. Who was it? Must have been someone she was trying to impress, but she remembered every line of every interview that touched her like this. "You've been so brave, Dawn," she said, squeezing her hand again. "Thank you very much for talking to me and giving me so much time. I'll contact Inspector Sparks to let him know when the story will appear, and I'll leave my card so you can get in touch whenever you want." Kate tidied up her things quickly, sliding the recorder into her bag and relinquishing her place beside Dawn to the family liaison officer. Sparks took her and Mick to the door.
That was great. Thanks, Bob, she said in his ear. I'll call you later when I've written it.
He nodded as she brushed past and out of the house to face her furious colleagues. In the car, she sat for a moment, running through the quotes in her head and trying to assemble the story. The intensity of the encounter had left her drained and, if she was honest, a little shaky. She wished she still smoked, but rang Steve's number instead. It went straight to voicemail. He'd be on the wards doing his surgical rounds, but she left a message. It went really well, she told him. Poor, poor girl. She'll never get over this. I've lifted a lasagna out of the freezer for tonight. Speak to you later. She could hear the catch in her voice as it recorded.
For goodness sake, pull yourself together, Kate. It's work, she told herself as she started the engine and pulled away to find a quiet car park and start writing. Must be getting old and feeble.
Dawn Elliott began ringing Kate Waters the next day, the day the story appeared. She rang from her mobile, standing in the bathroom, away from the ever-attentive Sue Blackman. She wasn't sure why she was making it a secret, but she needed something just for herself. Her whole life was being unpicked by the police, and she wanted to have something normal. Just a chat. Kate was thrilled. A direct line to the mother was the prize she'd allowed herself to hope for, but didn't take for granted, and she cultivated it carefully. There were to be no direct questions about the investigation. No prying, no pressing, no scaring her off. Instead, she talked to Dawn as if she were a friend, sharing details of her own life, her boys, traffic jams, new clothes and celebrity gossip. And Dawn responded as Kate knew she would eventually, confiding her fears and the latest police leads.
They've had a call from abroad, near Malaga? Someone on holiday there has seen a little girl in the park they think is Bella, she told Kate. Do you think she could be there?
Kate murmured reassurance while noting everything down and texting the crime correspondent, a hard-drinking hack who'd had a couple of bad misses lately. He was grateful to be included in Kate's exclusive tips, putting in calls to a contact in the incident room and telling the news editor to book a flight to Spain pronto. Not Bella. But the paper got an emotional interview with holidaymakers and a perfect excuse for another spread of photographs.
Well worth a go, the editor had said to the news desk, adding as he passed Kate's chair, Well done, Kate. You're doing a great job on this.
She had the inside track on the investigation, but she had to be careful. If Bob Sparks found out about the secret phone calls, it would not be pretty. She liked Sparks. They'd helped each other out on a couple of the cases he'd run. He'd given her the odd bit of information to make her story stand out from the rest of the packs, and she'd tipped him off when she got something new that might be interesting. It was a sort of friendship, she thought. Useful for both of them. And they got on well. But there was nothing deeper. She almost blushed when she remembered she'd developed a bit of schoolgirl crush on him when they first met in the 90s. She'd been drawn to his quietness and brown eyes, and had been flattered when he'd singled her out for a drink a couple of times. The crime man at her last paper had teased her about her cozy relationship with Sparks, but they both knew the detective was not a womanizer, like some of his colleagues. He was renowned for never straying, and Kate didn't have the time or the inclination for extramaritals.
He's a straight up and down copper, her colleague had said, one of the last.
Kate knew she risked burning Sparks as a contact by carrying on with Dawn behind the detective's back. But having the inside edge on the story was worth it. This could be her story of a lifetime. She rehearsed her arguments as she drove into work.
It's a free country, and Dawn can talk to whoever she wants, Bob. I can't stop her phoning me.
I'm not phoning her. I don't ask her any questions about the investigation. She just tells me stuff. She knew it wouldn't wash with Sparks. He'd got her in there in the first place. Oh, well, all's fair, she told herself irritably, making a silent promise to tell Bob anything that might help the police. She crossed her fingers at the same time. It didn't take long for the phone call from Sparks to come. Her phone rang, and she picked it up and headed for the privacy of the corridor. Hello, Bob. How are you? The detective was stressed and told her so. Dawn's latest bathroom conversation with her favorite reporter had been overheard by the liaison officer, and Sparks was disappointed in Kate. Somehow, that was worse than if he'd been furious. Hold on, Bob. Dawn Elliott is a grown woman. She can talk to whoever she wants. She rang me. I bet. Kate, this was not the deal. I got you in there for the first interview, and you've been sneaking around behind my back. It could affect the investigation. You do understand that? Look, Bob, she rings me for a chat that isn't about the investigation. She needs some time, even a couple of minutes, to escape. And you need stories. Don't play the social worker with me, Kate. I know you better than that. She felt ashamed. He did know her better than that. I'm sorry you're upset, Bob. Why don't I come down and meet you for a drink and we can talk things through? Too busy at the moment, but maybe next week. And Kate? Yes, yes. No doubt you've told her not to call me, but I'm not ignoring her if she does. I see. You'll have to do what you have to do, Kate. I hope Dawn will see sense then. Someone has to act like a responsible adult. Bob, I'm doing my job and you're doing yours. I'm not hurting the investigation. I'm keeping it alive in the paper. I hope you were right, Kate. Gotta go. Kate leaned on the wall, having a completely different argument with Bob Sparks in her head. In this version, she ended up on the higher moral ground, and Bob was groveling to her. Bob would come around when he calmed down, she told herself, and she texted Dawn to apologize for any trouble caused. She got a message back immediately that ended with, "Speak later." They were still on. She grinned at the screen and decided to celebrate with a double espresso and a muffin. "To life's little triumphs," she said, as she raised the cardboard cup in the cafeteria. She'd drive down to Southampton tomorrow and meet Dawn for a sandwich in the shopping centre.
Chapter 9. The Widow. Wednesday, June 9th, 2010. Kate gets in Mick's van a couple of miles farther on, in a supermarket car park. She laughs and says, the pack had rushed up the path to see if I was in the house when she drove off alone. Idiots, she says. Fancy falling for that. She has twisted around in the front seat so I can see her face. Are you all right, Jean? She says. Her voice has changed back to caring and gentle. I'm not fooled. She doesn't care about me. She just wants the story. I nod and keep quiet. As we drive, she and Mick chat about the office. Seems her boss is a bit of a bully, who shouts and swears at people. He uses the C-word so often, they call the morning news conference the vagina monologue, she tells me, and they both start laughing. I don't know what a vagina monologue is, but I don't let on. It's like she and Mick live in another world. Kate is telling him about how the news editor, the Terry she was talking to on the phone, is very happy. Happy that she has got the widow, I suppose. He'll be in and out of the editor's office all day, poor sod. Still, it'll stop him bitching at the other reporters. He's a funny bloke. Get him in the pub and he's the life and soul. But in the office, he sits at his desk 12 hours a day, staring at his computer screen. He only looks up to give someone a bollocking. He's like one of the living dead. Mick laughs. I lie down on the sleeping bag. It's a bit grubby, but it doesn't smell too bad, so I doze. and their voices fade into a background hum. When I wake up, we've arrived. The hotel is big and expensive. The sort of place that has those enormous flowers that practically fill the lobby, and real apples on the reception desk. I never know if those flowers are real, but the apples are. You can eat them if you want, the apples. Kate's in charge. Hi, you have 3 rooms for us, under the name Murray, she informs the receptionist, who smiles and looks at her screen. We only booked a couple of hours ago, Kate says impatiently. Here you are, the receptionist says finally. Mick must be the Murray. He gives his credit card to the lady, and she looks at me. I suddenly realize what I must look like. A sight. My hair's all over the place after having the jacket over my head and sleeping in the van. But I was hardly dressed to go to the shops, let alone a posh hotel. I stand there, in my old trousers and T-shirt, looking at my feet in my cheap flip-flops, while all the form-filling goes on. They put me down as Elizabeth Turner. And I look at Kate. She just smiles and whispers, "This way no one will find you. They'll be looking for us." I wonder who Elizabeth Turner really is and what she's doing this afternoon. I bet she's going through the racks at TJ Maxx, not hiding from the press. "Any bags?" the woman asks, and Kate says they're in the car and we'll get them out later. In the lift, I look at her and raise my eyebrows. She smiles back. We don't speak because there's a porter with us. Daft, really, because there's nothing to carry. But he wants to show us to our rooms and get a tip, I suppose. Room 142 is mine. Next door to Kate in 144. The porter makes a big show of opening the door and ushering me in. I stand and look. It's lovely. Huge and bright with a chandelier for a light. There's a sofa and a coffee table and lamps and more apples. They must have some sort of deal with Sainsbury's to have so much fruit around. Is this all right? Kate asks. Oh, yes, I say, and sit down on the sofa to look at it all again. Our honeymoon hotel wasn't as posh as this. It was a family-run place in Spain. Still, that was lovely too. We had such a laugh. When we got there, I still had bits of confetti in my hair, and the staff made a big fuss over us. There was a bottle of champagne waiting, Spanish stuff, which was a bit sickly, and the waitresses kept coming up and kissing us. We spent our days lying by the pool, looking at each other, loving each other. Such a long time ago. Kate says there's a pool here, and a spa. I haven't got a swimsuit or anything, really, but she asks my size and sets off to get me some things. The paper will pay, she says. She books me a massage for while she's out. To relax you, she says. It'll be lovely. They use essential oils, jasmine, lavender, that sort of thing. And you can go to sleep on the table. You need a bit of pampering, Jean. I'm not sure, but I go along with it. I haven't asked how long they are keeping me here. The subject hasn't come up, and they seem to be treating it like a weekend break. An hour later, I'm lying on the bed in a hotel dressing gown, floating just above the covers. I feel so relaxed. Glenn would have said I smell like a tart's boudoir, but I love it. I smell expensive. Then Kate knocks, and I'm back where I started. Back to reality. She comes through the door with loads of shopping bags. Here you go, Jean, she says. Try these on to see if they fit. Funny how she keeps using my name. Like a nurse or a con man. She has chosen lovely things. A pale blue cashmere jumper I could never have afforded. A smart white shirt. A floaty skirt. A pair of tailored grey trousers. Knickers, shoes, a swimsuit. Luxury bubble bath. And a beautiful long nightie. I unpack it while she watches. I love that colour, don't you, Jean? She says, picking up the jumper. Duck egg blue. She knows I love it too. But I try not to show too much. Thank you, I say. I really don't need all this. I'm only here overnight. Perhaps you can take some of it back. She doesn't reply, just gathers up the empty bags and smiles.
It's well past lunchtime, and they decide to have something to eat in Kate's room. All I want is a sandwich, but Mick orders steak and a bottle of wine. I look afterward, and the wine was £32. You could get 8 bottles of Chardonnay for that at the supermarket. He said it was effing delicious. He uses the F word a lot, but Kate doesn't seem to notice. Her attention is all on me. When the plates are put outside the door to be collected, Mick goes off to his room to sort out his cameras, and Kate settles back in an armchair and starts chatting. Just normal chat. The sort of thing I would say to a client while I was shampooing her hair. But I know it can't last. You must have been under a terrible strain since Glenn's death, she begins. I nod and look strained. I can't tell her I haven't. The truth is that the relief has been wonderful. How have you coped, Jean? It's been terrible, I say with a catch in my voice, and switch back to being Jeannie, the woman I used to be when I first got married. Jeannie saved me. She bumbled on with her life, cooking tea, washing customers' hair, sweeping the floor and making the beds. She knew that Glenn was a victim of a police plot. She stood by the man she married, the man she chose. At first, Jeannie reappeared only when family or the police asked questions. But as more bad stuff began to leak under the door, Jeannie moved back into the house so Glenn and I could carry on our life together. It was a terrible shock, I tell Kate. He fell under the bus right there in front of me. I didn't even have time to call out. He was gone. Then all these people came running up and kind of took over. I was too shocked to move, and they took me to the hospital to make sure I was all right. Everyone was so kind. Until they found out who he was. You see, the police said Glenn had taken Bella. When they said her name, when they came to our house, all I could think of was her picture. That little face, those little round glasses, and the plaster over one eye. She looked like a baby pirate. So sweet, I could have eaten her. No one had been able to talk about anything else for months. In the salon, in the shops, on the bus, little Bella. She was playing in the garden outside her house in Southampton, and someone just walked in and took her. Of course, I'd never have let a child of mine play outside on her own. She was only 2 and a half, for goodness sake. Her mum should have taken better care of her. Bet she was sat watching Jeremy Kyle or some rubbish like that. It's always people like that these things happen to, Glenn says. Careless people. And they said it was Glenn who took her and killed her. I couldn't breathe when they said it. The police, I mean. They were the first. Others said it later. We stood there in our front hall with our mouths open. Well, I say we. Glenn sort of went blank. His face was blank. He didn't look like Glenn anymore. The police were quiet when they came. No banging down the door or anything like on the telly. They knocked. Rat-tat-tat-tat-tat. Glenn had only just come in from cleaning the car. He opened the door, and I put my head around the kitchen door to see who it was. It was 2 blokes asking to come in. One looked like my geography teacher at school, Mr. Harris, same tweedy jacket. Mr. Glenn Taylor, Mr. Harris asked, all quiet and calm. Yes, Glenn said, and asked if they were selling something. I couldn't hear properly at the beginning. But then they came in. They were policemen. Detective Inspector Bob Sparks and his sergeant, they said. Mr. Taylor, I'd like to talk to you about the disappearance of Bella Elliott, D.I. Sparks said. And I opened my mouth to say something, to make the policeman stop saying these things, but I couldn't. And Glenn's face went blank. He never looked at me once the whole time. Never put his arm around me or touched my hand. He said later he was in shock. He and the policeman carried on talking, but I can't remember hearing what they were saying. I watched their mouths moving, but I couldn't take it in. What had Glenn got to do with Bella? He wouldn't harm a hair on a child's head. He loved children. Then they left, Glenn and the policeman. Glenn told me later that he said goodbye and told me not to worry. It was just a stupid mix-up he'd sought out. But I don't remember that. Other policemen stayed at the house to ask me questions, to root around in our lives. But through it all, going around and around in my brain, I kept thinking about his face and how I didn't know him for a second. He told me later someone had said he'd been making a delivery near where Bella disappeared. But that didn't mean anything. Just a coincidence, he said. There must have been hundreds of people in the area that day. He'd been nowhere near the scene of the crime. His delivery was miles away, he said, but the police were going through everyone to check if they saw anything. He'd started as a delivery driver after he'd got laid off by the bank. They were looking for redundancies, he told people, and he fancied a change. He'd always dreamed of having the chance to start his own business, be his own boss. The night I discovered the real reason was a Wednesday. Aerobics and a late supper for us. He shouted at me about why I was later than usual. Horrible, tight words spat out, angry and dirty. Words he never used normally. Everything was wrong. He was crowding the kitchen with his accusations, his anger. His eyes were dead, as if he didn't know me either. I thought he was going to hit me. I watched his fists clench and unclench at his sides, me frozen at the cooker, spatula in my hand. My kitchen, my rules, we used to joke. But not that Wednesday. Wednesday's child is full of woe. The row ended with a slammed door as he marched off to bed, to sleep on the sofa bed in the spare room, cut off from me. I remember standing at the foot of the stairs, numb. What was this about? What had happened? I didn't want to think about what it meant for us. Stop it, I told myself. It'll be all right. He must have had a bad day. Let him sleep it off. I started tidying, picking up his scarf and jacket where he'd hung them on the banister, and putting them on the coat hooks by the door. I felt something stiff in one pocket. A letter. A white envelope with a see-through panel, with his name and our address showing. From the bank. The words were official, and as stiff as the envelope. Inquiry, unprofessional behaviour, inappropriate, and termination forthwith. I was lost in the formal language, but I knew this meant disgrace. The end of our dreams, our future. Clutching the letter in my hand, I ran up the stairs. I marched into the spare room and flicked on the light. He must have heard me coming and pretended to be asleep, until I heard myself screech, "What is this about?" He looked at me like I was nothing. "I've been fired," he said, and rolled back over to pretend to sleep. The next morning, Glenn came into our bedroom with a cup of tea in my favourite cup. He looked like he'd hardly slept and said he was sorry. He sat down on the bed and said he was under a lot of pressure, and it was all a misunderstanding at work, and that he'd never got on with the boss. He said he'd been set up and blamed for something. Some mistake, he said. He'd done nothing wrong. His boss was jealous. Glenn said he had big plans for his future, but that didn't matter if I wasn't beside him. "You are the centre of my world, Jeannie," he said, and held me close, and I hugged him back and let go of my fear. Mike, a friend he said he met on the internet, told him about the driving job. "Just while I work out what business I want to get into, Jeannie," Glenn said. It was cash in hand at first, and then they took him on permanently. He stopped talking about being his own boss. He had to wear a uniform. It was quite smart, a pale blue shirt with the company logo on the pocket and navy trousers. Glenn didn't like wearing a uniform. "It's demeaning, Jeannie, like being back at school." But he got used to it and seemed happy enough. He'd go out in the morning and wave as he drove off to pick up the van. Off on his travels, he'd say. I went with him only once. Special job for the boss on a Sunday, just before Christmas 1 year. Must have been the Christmas before he was arrested. It was only down to Canterbury, and I fancied a run out. We sat in total silence on the way down. I rooted through his glove box, just stuff, some sweets. I helped myself and offered one to Glenn to cheer him up. He didn't want it and told me to put them back. The van was lovely and clean, spotless. I never really saw it normally. It was kept at the depot. And he took his car to pick it up in the mornings. Nice van, I said, but he just grunted. What's in the back? Nothing, he said, and turned up the radio. And he was right. I had a look when he was talking to the customer. The back was as clean as a whistle. Well, almost. There was a corner torn from a sweet packet, poking out from under one edge of the mat. I got it out with my fingernail. It was a bit fuzzy and dusty, but I put it in my coat pocket, to be tidy. It all seems so long ago, us going for a drive like normal people. But it was only 3 years ago. Glenn Taylor, the nurse is saying to me, startling me out of my thoughts and frowning as she writes his name on a form, trying to remember. I wait for the inevitable. The penny drops. Glenn Taylor, the one accused of taking that little girl, Bella, she says quietly to one of the paramedics, and I pretend not to hear. When she turns back to me, her face is harder. I see, she says, and walks away. She must have made a phone call because half an hour later the press is there, hanging around the casualty department, trying to look like patients. I could spot them a mile off. I keep my head down and refuse to speak to any of them. What sort of people are they, hounding a woman who's just seen her husband die? The police are there too, because of the accident. They're not the ones we usually see. They're the local police, the Met, not the Hampshire officers. Just doing routine work, taking statements from the witnesses, from me, from the driver of the bus. He's here too. Apparently he got a nasty knock to the head when he braked and says he didn't even see Glenn step out. He probably didn't. It was that fast. Then D.I. Sparks shows up. I knew he'd turn up eventually, like a bad penny. But he must have driven like the wind to get here from Southampton so quickly. He's all sad face and condolences for me, but he's even sadder for himself. He certainly doesn't want Glenn dead. Him gone means that the case will never be closed. Poor Bob. He'll be stuck with that failure all his life. He sits down beside me on a plastic chair and reaches for my hand. I'm so embarrassed I let him. He has never touched me like this before, like he cares for me. He holds my hand and speaks in a soft, low voice. I know what he's saying, but I don't hear it, if you know what I mean. He's asking me if I know what Glenn did with Bella. He's saying it nicely, telling me I can let go of the secret now. Everything can be told. I was as much a victim as Bella was. I don't know anything about Bella, Bob. Neither did Glenn, I say, and take my hand away, pretending I need it to wipe away a tear. Later, I'm sick in the hospital toilets. I clean myself up and sit on the loo with my forehead resting on the lovely cool tiles on the wall.
Chapter 10. The Detective. Thursday, October 12th, 2006. The detective was standing in the incident room, scanning the boards for emerging patterns and links, taking off his glasses and narrowing his eyes in case a change of focus might reveal something. There was, apparently, a maelstrom of activity all around the Elliot's garden. But at the epicenter, Bella remained the missing piece. All that information, but not a sign of her, Sparks thought. She's here somewhere. We're missing something. The forensic team had dusted and swabbed every inch of the brick garden wall and painted metal gate. The garden had been the subject of a fingertip search by a line of police officers, making a religious progress on their knees and, like holy relics of the child, fibers from her clothes, golden hairs from her head, dismembered toy parts, and discarded sweet wrappings touched by her had been preserved in plastic bags. But of the abductor, nothing. I think the bastard must have reached over the wall and lifted her straight over and into his vehicle, Spark said. It would have taken only seconds. She was there, and then she wasn't. The team had found a half-sucked red sweet on Bella's side of the wall. Maybe it fell out of her mouth when he picked her up, Spark said. Is it a Smartie? I'm not exactly an expert on Smarties, boss, but I'll get someone to check, Sergeant Matthews said. When it came back from forensics, it had been identified as a Skittle. Bella's saliva was on the sweet, matched with the comforter she sucked at night. She never had Skittles, Dawn said. He gave her one to keep her quiet, Sparks thought. How old-fashioned. He remembered his mum telling him as a boy, never take sweets from a stranger. That, and something about men with puppies. He was reviewing the list of evidence, and his energy was dipping. It didn't look good. There were no CCTV cameras watching over the street, only good old Mr. Spencer, and no images so far of a scruffy man collected from the nearest camera sites. Maybe he was just lucky, Spark said. Luck of the devil, then. Get on the phone, Matthews, and see when we can get on Crime Watch. Tell them it's urgent. The television reconstruction seemed to take forever to organize, although it was only 8 days. A Bella look-alike had to be found from a nursery school in another town, because no parent living near the Westland estate would let their child take part. Can't blame them, really, Sparks told the exasperated director. They don't want to see their kid as a kidnap victim, even a pretend one. They were waiting at the end of Manor Road for the film crew to set up, discussing what Sparks would say in his appeal for information. The appeal is live in the studio after we screen the reconstruction, Bob, the director said. So make sure you have everything sorted in your head before you speak. You'll know what questions you're going to get. Sparks was too distracted to take it all in. He had just put Dawn Elliott in a police car to her mum's as the actress playing her arrived. She looks like me, she'd whispered to him. She hadn't been able to look at the child playing Bella. She had laid out a set of her daughter's clothes, a little headband, and Bella's spare glasses on the sofa, stroking each item and saying her child's name. Sparks had helped her up, and she had walked, dry-eyed and holding his arm, to the car. She got in beside Sue Blackman and didn't look back. The street was now quiet, deserted as it must have been that day. Sparks watched as the reenactment took shape, the director gently coaching Bella to chase a borrowed grey cat into the garden. Her mother stood just off camera, with emergency chocolate buttons in case bribes were needed, smiling at her little girl and trying not to cry. Mrs. Emerson volunteered to play her own small role, walking stiffly down her garden path, pretending to look for her little friend next door, and then responding to Dawn's cries for help. Across the road, Mr. Spencer acted out spotting the actor in a long wig strolling past his house, his mimed puzzlement filmed through the bay window by a cameraman standing on Mrs. Spencer's French marigolds. The abduction took only minutes, but it was 3 hours later that the director was satisfied, and everyone crowded around the monitor in the film truck to watch the end product. No one spoke as they watched Bella playing in the garden, and only Mr. Spencer remained
to mull over the events. Afterward, one of the older officers took Sparks aside.
Have you noticed that our Mr. Spencer is always hanging around the investigation team and giving interviews to the reporters? Telling them he saw the man who took her? Bit of a glory seeker, if you ask me.
Sparks smiled sympathetically.
There's always one, isn't there? He's probably lonely and bored. I'll get Matthews to keep an eye on him.
As expected, the broadcast, 23 days after Bella vanished, triggered hundreds of phone calls to the studio and incident room, the film igniting public emotion and a fresh outpouring of variations on My Heart Goes Out To and Why, Oh Why messages on the show's website. About a dozen callers claimed to have seen Bella, many of whom were sure they had spotted her in a cafe, on a beach, in a playground. Each call was acted upon immediately, but Sparks's optimism began to fade as he took his turn answering the phones at the back of the Crime Watch television studio. The following week, a sudden buzz of voices from the incident room reached Sparks as he walked down the corridor.
"Got a flasher in a kid's playground, sir," the duty officer told him. "About 25 minutes from the Elliott house." "Who is he? Is he known to us?"
Lee Chambers was a middle-aged, divorced minicab driver who'd been questioned 6 months earlier for exposing himself to two female passengers. He claimed he was just having a quick pee, and they caught a glimpse as he zipped himself up. Completely unintentional. The women didn't want to take it further, didn't want the attention, and the police sent him on his way. Today he'd been in bushes beside the swings and slides,